I'm going to have you do an exercise here. Go back to your late 20s. You have no experience in professional sports, but you want to start a team in a league that's going to take on one of the major four professional sports loops in North America. And you do it. That's what Howard Baldwin did. And he joins us today to tell a whole bunch of great stories of the World Hockey Association. It's awesome.
Boys, I'm Mike today. Just let everyone know, don't say anything stupid.
Heads up! Oh, how'd that feel, old man? I'm going to run you. I'm just waiting for my shift.
That's a disgrace. That's a disgrace. What a joke.
Different type episode this week on The Chirp with Darren Millard, because we're going to put all the current mainstream hockey talk aside and go back in time. And you're going to hear the name Ted Lasso a couple of times, and it's with good reason, because today's guest, Howard Baldwin, is Ted Lasso the series way before the internet, way before any of this became cool, streaming channels, all that kind of stuff. Basically, anything you see in your room where you're listening to this or wherever you are, none of that existed unless you're like in the mountains. The mountains existed. We're talking about the World Hockey Association, 50th anniversary of the WHA, and Howard Baldwin, who is a character. He didn't start the WHA, but he was one of its founding members, in the sense of he had to pitch a league that didn't exist that he could be owner. And he didn't have really any of the financials to make it happen, but it worked. And then we get into the steps along the way. Bobby Hull, Gordie Howe, paying players out of paper bags. There's some craziness, but there's also a lot of stuff in this discussion that will make you go, well, that's kind of mainstream now. That happens all the time. It's Howard Baldwin, a movie producer, a sports owner, a Stanley Cup champion, and a guy that was way ahead of his time. And I'm so glad that he's doing a podcast series called Slim and None. You have to check it out. And today is a primer with the man himself. I'm a lifer in the hockey world, and just beyond my fingertips has been Howard Baldwin for all these years. And I finally have tracked you down, able to chat with you. I'm really looking forward to this. Give me an idea. You're a movie guy. Does the WHA sound more truth or fiction when you look back at it?
Well, it sounds like fiction, but it is truth. And that's what makes it so fun, because you have everything in this story that are the hot buttons for the film business. David versus Goliath. You have a load of humor. And frankly, you got a load of drama. And we always pitch it out here. It's Ted Lasso comes to the hockey world. And but that was fiction. This is all real. And people say when we talk to writers and everything, well, what kind of creative liberties can we have? And we say, well, if you really think you need any, let us know. But I can't think of something that didn't happen over the 7 years of this league.
Have you ever thought of doing a movie on the WHA?
We are developing it now, as Bob is aware, as a series, an ongoing series. And we're in the process of tying down a deal for one of the top writer showrunners out here. And there's a couple of other good marquee names that'll be a part of it. And I have no doubt we'll get it on.
Well, that's a great bit of carrot for everybody to get on board before we get right into it. So set the stage for us. So why do you want to get into hockey to begin with? Because I know that started before the World Hockey Association.
Yeah, it did. I mean, I remember I was in the 60s. And it was unheard of for an American kid coming out of prep school to get into hockey as a player, that's for sure. And I'm not even suggesting I was good enough, so don't think I'm saying that, but I was a pretty good hockey player. But I realized as close as I was going to get to being on the ice or on the field was to get in the office. And so that was my mission, to try to get hooked up with some office, some front office, anywhere in sports, and hockey all the better, because that was my first love.
Who was the team?
Well, it was the Philadelphia Flyers. My family had close connections to J.P. Morgan, the bank. and so there was a connection there through a lending officer named Bill Putnam. a great guy. And he had done some lending with Jack M. Cook. And then, so I met him and he said, hey, if anything ever comes up, I'll give you a call and see whether it can work. So oddly enough, a few months after that, he left J.P. Morgan and went to work for Jack M. Cook in L.A. And he immediately, very loyally, called me and said, hey, we could use a ticket manager out here. Would you be interested? And he said, Jack Kent Cook is coming to New York City. Now, can you imagine that? Jack Kent Cook wanted to interview the ticket manager. So I said, listen, I would be thrilled and honored, but here's what happened. I happened to be in the Marine Corps, and I got hurt in the Marine Corps. And I said, I'm afraid I won't be good for anybody here for 3 or 4 months. And in those 3 or 4 months, Putnam left LA and went to the Flyers, or the expansion effort of the Flyers. And as you know, the Flyers got the expansion team and Bill called up and said, look, we're going to buy a piece of a little minor league team in Jersey called the Jersey Devils and come down and be operations manager. And there it began.
And then you end up with the Philadelphia Flyers. And my head's spinning, Howard. Jack Kent Cook on one. No, you got Jack Kent Cook on one side and you got Ed Snyder on the other. Like you're right in the middle of hockey royalty at the time.
There's no question, but neither one of them knew who the heck I was. Jack Kent Cook did. I actually had a phone call with him. And then wouldn't you know, the first deal I ever voted on, we got in the NHL, was Jack Kent Cook selling the LA Kings and all his empire to Jerry Buss. But with Snyder, I didn't even meet Snyder until middle of the first year with the Devils. So really, Bill Putnam and Bud Poile and Keith Allen were the guys I dealt with.
What was Ed like? And I want to get into this World Hockey Association thing, but I got to go down the path of Mr.
Sure,
Snyder.
Sure. None better. I loved him. He was a surrogate father, whatever you want to call. He's passed. Probably one of the greatest guys on the planet. And a classic example of an owner that worked, rolled up his sleeves and worked. And frankly, so did Putnam and so did Joe Scott, who were owners. But Eddie worked morning, noon, and night. And that franchise is what it is today because of Ed Snyder.
When you went down the path of the World Hockey Association, did you ask Mr. Snyder for his advice on your plans?
Well, what happened is I had 4 years there, a wonderful experience. Yeah. And some bee in my bonnet said, it's time to leave. I got to strike out on my own. Because, you know, then the front offices were tiny. And so I left on excellent terms. And when we did get involved in the WHA and with the Whalers, then my contact with Ed became a little more frequent, but always, always respectful. He thought it was cool what I was doing. And
really, because he was on the other side of it, right, Howard?
Yeah, but Eddie was great. You see, he succeeded. He won those two cups. If you'll look at his, he got it. He got the WHA and he said, this could work. This could work. Remember, he was in the NFL and they had to deal with the AFL. He said, I'm going on the fact that this is going to work and I'm going to sign my players and these guys aren't going to get any of my players. And that's exactly what he did. Some of the other guys in the NHL, like most of them, didn't get it. And so they didn't thrive in the 70s the way Ed did.
Before there was players changing leagues, you had to get a franchise. What was that process like? Smoke and mirrors or on the up and up?
Laughter
says it all.
I wouldn't kid you. It was smoke and mirrors through and through. And until we got the franchise from smoke and mirrors, fun story is the first meeting was at the Hotel Americana in October of 1971. And I don't know how many guys were there, but we were there for New England. We went in, made the presentation, and they rejected it or said, you got to come back because we hadn't resolved the place to play. And we obviously had to have an arena because you had Boston Garden and that was it in New England. Providence building an arena. So they said, come back in 30 days. So we do whatever we can to get a place to play. And we kind of cobbled something together with the Boston Arena and maybe the Boston Garden, and went down there and said, look, here's what we have. They made it seem like there were people lined up to get a franchise. There weren't. There was one other guy from Ottawa, Doug Michelle. He was a roofer, contractor or something. I don't know what he was. A good guy. Anyway, they bring us in the room and they'd say, well, good. You guys did a great presentation. And you've got the franchise. And we said, great. And we had come with our check for $25,000 and $10,000 league dues. And they quickly informed us that the price went from $25,000 to $250,000.
What?
Yeah. And so, and we just looked at each other. Remember, we were 28, 29 years old. And so we looked at each other, Kobe and I and Godfrey Wood, and just said, well, let's step outside. And we stepped outside, looked at each other, and just burst out laughing. We said, look, we don't have any money anyway. So let's just say yes. Because they weren't going to make us pay the difference until the February meeting in Quebec. So we came back in the room and said, fine, we're good to go. And we're in, and they hugged us and all of that stuff. And we left Miami, of all places, with the franchise. And then fairly shortly thereafter, we, with a stroke of good fortune, we got the financing. But we never paid the $250,000, I will tell you that.
How much money did you have if they were asking for $250,000? How much money was in the collective group?
25 and 10. That's all. My parents and partners' parents, we all, there was family money, okay? And that probably helped, but they weren't giving it to us, believe me. So we went on a wing and a prayer. You've heard that expression from day one. And just said, look, we've come this far with a lot of BS. Let's keep going, see what happens.
Did you think on the wing and the prayer it was going to fly?
You're young and you just figure you're infallible. You know, if I had to do it today at this stage of my life, I'd have a heart attack. But then, you know, he just said, screw it, I'm going for it. And my partner, Johnny Coburn, was the same way. And so was my other partner, who were all just sort of the seed group putting this together. But none of us had money. And I'm trying to figure out how we got that. We got the $10,000 from a friend back in Massachusetts. And for the $10,000, we gave him like 2 or 3% of the franchise. And I think somehow we cobbled together a loan for the $25,000. And that was it.
If somebody came to you today with that plan, would you have given them $10,000?
Yeah. I guess if I had a lot of money and I never earned it, which was the case with this fella, I might. Yeah.
Where did the Whalers name come from? Because I've listened to a bunch, and I know it was volunteered by somebody within the group, but I've never heard of why and where it came from.
Again, another fun story. We hired Jack Kelly, who was a great coach at BU.
Yep.
Okay. And he actually, I knew him from my brief time at BU. I tried out for the team and we always joke. And he said, I always say he cut me, but he didn't. But I knew I couldn't. I had gotten out of the military. There's no way I was up for playing there. But we always kind of, I don't know, there was something we just liked each other. And so we reached out to Jack. We hired Jack. And we came up with a list of names, and his wife, Ginny Kelly, picked a name. She should get all the credit for picking the name, Whalers, because she did. And so that's the story. And you may or may not know this, but their son, David E. Kelly, is a force in television out here.
Yes.
A dear, dear friend, and was our stick boy the first year of the Whalers.
David E. Kelly was a stick boy?
Yeah, for the Oilers, yeah. He'd come in and work the games on the weekend for his father. And if you look in the little book I wrote, you'll see his picture there at the end of the first year when we won the championship. You'll see David in the background with a big grin. And we did David's first movie. So that's a whole separate story. But yeah, that's it.
When did you think it was going to actually come to the point where you're going to play, where you're going to actually get a game in?
Oh, I felt once we got that franchise, we'd figure it out. And I figured once we got that, now the WHA for the 7 years I was in it, and I was the only one that was there from day one to day whatever. I likened the June meetings to Russian roulette. And that's the way it was. We'd sit around at the annual meeting in June, who's in, who's out, who's going to be able to do it. So it was shaky all the way through. But somehow we knew at the beginning that we'd get it going. And once we got that first year in, you know, we knew we're going to somehow keep this together. But every year it was Russian roulette. Every year we were on like hanging on a ledge.
Why did you go with the plan to pay for Bobby Hull, even though he wasn't going to play for your team?
That was a real easy one. Then at the time, he was a super superstar, right?
Yeah.
And you know, a lot of the players were skeptical. Allen Eagleson wasn't really supportive of the league. He was like a reluctant use of the league as leverage to get higher money for and then sign with the NHL. And frankly, I don't blame anyone for doing that. But we knew we had to make a splash. And when Benny Hatskins from Winnipeg came and said, look, we can sign Hull. It'll be $1 million signing bonus. And then he'd pay the $250 a year for 5 years. We just said, it's a no-brainer. We had to do it. Now, $1 million divided by 12, you know, not that big a deal, though then it was a lot of money. But I think only three or four of us came up with the money. Cleveland did. Of course, Benny had to chip in more. And Quebec did, you know, but half the teams didn't.
But it's crazy to think that you would pay even though he wasn't going to play for you. And now we've seen that almost commonplace in different leagues.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it is crazy. And I think that might've been the first one that was ever done like that.
Yeah.
You know, and yet I think most people would agree that that transaction was kind of like the league's going to make it for how long, who the hell knows, but it's going to make it. It's going to get off the ground. And if you check your history, which I've done with Bob and others, you'll see there were a lot of signings with some pretty good players right after Hull signed. It gave the players the courage to say, hey, if Hull can go, if they can come up with $1 million signing bonus, we can do it. We can take that chance and go.
Did Bobby ever thank you?
Oh, I've had a good relationship with Bobby, and I'll tell you the fun thing. I think it's episode 12 or 11 in the first year of the podcast. We do a great interview with him, and he was fantastic. He got emotional, talked about his early days as a kid playing the hockey night in Canada, Foster Hewitt coming on. He was as good as it gets on that interview. So, yeah, we stay in touch.
What about Gordie Howe? How did you come in touch with him and the ability to bring him on?
Okay, Gordie, the second year of the WHA, Billy Dineen from Houston had drafted the house. Okay, and Billy was brilliant. And he knew Mark and Marty, particularly Mark, was going to be a superstar. And he didn't really know whether he'd be able to get Gordie to play or not. But then Colleen, very early on, said to Billy, hey, how would you like a third Hal? So the three of them came to Houston. And that was like, what do you do for an encore after the first year? Well, that was a great encore. And then, as you know, in 77, I believe it is, he came, you know, we brought him into Hartford because Houston was having a few difficulties. And I think it was just sort of a relationship on both sides that had to end. So then they came to Hartford, which was huge for us because we were kind of so-so on the ice And it gave us a huge shot in the right parts.
What kind of shot? Like, what are we talking about impact with the Hartford Whalers?
It almost doubled our season tickets. Now, we always did well. We started in a 10,500 seat building there in Hartford, and our paid attendance never really dropped below 70% paid, which is pretty darn good because it was such a community team. But we were getting to the point we were sort of in the middle of the pack, and we needed a boost. We needed some kind of a boost. So signing the house gave it that boost. I mean, there's a small market, smallest market in all of professional sports at the time, and sort of had a complex, well, we're between Boston and New York, and you know, getting one of the four or five greatest players ever to play the game of hockey to come to Hartford with his two boys was just an amazing story.
Do you think Hartford will ever get a team again or deserve a team?
Yeah, that's a fair question. The market that I knew in 19, when I left, which was 1988, my wife and I left to come out here because the corporate community said, we got to sell the team now, Howard. And, you know, we've done our thing. I can tell you it was a great market. And one of the things I did when I left, and we got the highest price at the time we sold it, Darren, we got the highest price in the history of the NHL for that small market.
What was that price? Do you remember?
$33 million cash.
Wow.
And, yeah. And, you know, quite a bit up from $25,000.
Yeah.
And look what it is now. But I did say, and I still have the report to the executive committee, all of whom were wonderful. They were wonderful to me and to the team. I said, don't ever sell 100% of the team. Always keep your hand on where the team plays. Because I had control. I never had more than 5 or 10% equity. But I always controlled the franchise, except for movement of the franchise. Hmm. And I couldn't move it if I wanted to. Do you see what I mean? And they never should. They didn't listen to me. And they, of course, didn't keep that in their agreement with the two fellas that bought it. And, you know, individuals do different things than corporations who have a corporate conscience for the city they work in. And so it left. Now, it should never have left. They had a lot of season tickets in the late 90s. And it was a clash of egos between Peter Komarnos and the governor, John Rowland. Just really sad. Now, whether they deserve a team today, I don't know. I'm not there anymore. But I think they'll have a hell of a hard time getting it unless they take the bull by the horns and build an arena, you know, with the attitude of build it and they will come. The fans there are the best. I love them. But the leadership there in the city and the state and the corporate community, I don't think exists any longer.
The podcast is outstanding, and you walk through so many different events over the course of launching the WHA and into the World Hockey Association. What are two or three points that you say, like, that never would have happened without us doing it, that maybe the National Hockey League has adopted along the way?
Well, if you step back and if you look to 1966, okay, they had six teams. For 50 years, and you know them as well as I do, six. And then in 66, they announced an expansion, early 67. Now, 66, what am I talking about? And they doubled the size of the league, okay? And then within a year and a half, they add two. And then the WHA comes along, okay? And that's 12 teams. And so in 74, not to get too, you know, analytical here, you went from 66 to 74, you went from six teams to, I think it's 32 or 34. And that was an explosion for the workforce. And it was an explosion in identifying new markets. And it was an explosion really legally, because we quickly, all one had to do, and I'm not a lawyer, Bob and I were just talking about that. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a lawyer, but I can tell you it did not take much to abolish their reserve clause. And so that changed the world, changed it in basketball with the ABA. in football, it had changed it, you know, with the AFL. Yep. But in hockey, it really changed it dramatically, because you opened up new markets and new opportunities for players, coaches, executives, the whole nine yards. And we had some rule changes, but not so dramatic, but, you know, the red line and overtime, you know, things like that. But fundamentally, the game was still the game they were used to in the NHL. But ours, if anything, you might say we were a little more offensive, you know. It's like in basketball, you have the slam dunk and the three-pointer all brought about by the ABA. You can say that the WHA did the same thing, you know, to make the game more fun is a good way to put it. That group that we competed with, none of them are left there. So I can say this now without them doing anything to me. They weren't a very fun group, I can tell you that. Eddie was fun. I had a lot of fun with Eddie Snyder. Fun with Harold Ballard, or the chairman of Molson's. Come on. So you had us, which were in the WHA, a group of young, you know, whatever you wanted to call us, against the stodgy NHL. I mean, you could not create a better villain than they were.
Did you see yourself as a villain?
Oh, no. The NHL I saw as a villain.
Okay. But I wonder whether you guys saw yourself as, we're going to take these guys down. We're the bad boys.
Yeah. No, they were, in my mind, they were the villain. And I'm sure they saw us as a villain, but they saw us as monstrous pain in the you know what.
Yeah. That's probably the better way to put it.
There's no way they didn't like us. And I could have cared less. We were on a mission. That's all.
More personality for sure in the WHA. Was that organic or was it planned?
Another good, you see, the guys that came into the WHA, like me and like some others, it was like if your fantasy is to own a team, you could get into the WHA for like in the original 12 for 25 grand.
Yeah.
Most, you know, a lot of people could just take a second mortgage on their home, and all of a sudden they're a big shot in their hometown. Okay. But what they don't realize is it's a business that can take you to your knees really quickly. Mm. So I think our group of owners had a better spirit in that it wasn't handed to us. You know, if you look at the NHL ownership with the Adams family, the Wirtz family, the Norris family, you know, it was a lot of old money that kind of ran these teams as if it was a club, you know, having a racehorse. Whereas we had to make it work. We couldn't, you know, we didn't have the luxury. Not many people in the WHA, particularly in the beginning, had a lot of wealth. When we got into like the third, fourth year, we got people like Jimmy Patterson in Vancouver, a fabulous guy, and I'm very wealthy. Yeah. You got Ray Kroc in San Diego. Imagine that, McDonald's. Yeah, he was in the league not for long. He quickly realized that maybe this isn't going to be so profitable. he was in there. So there isn't any question you had with the WHA, that entrepreneurial spirit that the NHL didn't have.
Did you make money?
In the WHA? No. Oh, no. I don't know that there was a single team that did. And what happened starting in about year four, people realized, certainly my ownership and my partners realized, you know, this is probably a league that is going to stagger along. And my mandate was to either get a merger or, frankly, jump leagues, quite frankly. And we had probably this in Hartford, we had the strongest ownership, certainly in the NHL and WHA. I mean, it was a massively powerful ownership group. So the mission then became, and that's why I said I would become president of the league, which I spent probably a little more time on than I did with the Whalers, because my mission was to do what had to be done to get a merger with the NHL.
So you took that presidency knowing that the path had to be a combining of the two leagues.
Absolutely. 100% right, Darren. Yeah.
Did everybody else know that?
Everybody else being?
The other franchises?
Oh, yeah. What happened is you had the guys like in Edmonton, Winnipeg, Quebec. And then Houston, Cincinnati, Billy DeWitt in Cincinnati, fabulous guy. He owns the Cardinals now, and he's done such a wonderful job with them. How could you do better? We all knew we had to, Johnny Bassett, we knew that this was not going to, it's just so, and even with Johnny, God rest his soul, Johnny knew Birmingham wasn't going to get in the NHL, but he also knew if he could hang on and if the merger happened, there'd be a payout for him, which there was. So that became sort of the battle cry for the last, really the last 3 years of the league.
Would you do it again?
Oh, hell yeah. I had a blast. I loved it. It was fun. So, yeah, I mean, would I do it again at my age today? Heck no. But then it was an adventure. It was an adventure, and it was just a different time. And I'd do it again. You bet.
What was the most fun, and then what was the most stressful part about those years?
Well,
you won a lot.
We won a lot, but I really, and I cared about that because I'm very competitive. But I knew we had to get this merger done. Well, I knew if we didn't get it done that in that, 78-79 season, that would probably be it. Maybe we could squeak another year out, but I didn't think so. And so really when we got we had two strikes and missed, didn't quite connect. And the third one was fall of 78, December, when they at their meeting down there in Florida. And we were so convinced that it was John Ziegler, who was wonderful for the NHL, felt for sure we're going to get it done. He was that confident. So I had the CFO of the Aetna. He had the jet ready to go at 8 a.m. to go down and announce it. And 8 a.m, I get the call. And it was John Ziegler saying, how are you? He was in tears. He said, we didn't get the votes. Two guys flipped their votes, Montreal and Vancouver. And so that was really, we could only throw out our chests like I did that afternoon in the press conference and say, well, we're going to go back and we're going to do this, that, and the other thing. But I didn't really believe we could do it. And then literally the next morning, I got the call from John Ziegler saying, these votes, that the ownership got really mad at the people that were voting. And we can get the votes, hold your people together. And we did very quickly. I mean, like within 3 or 4 days, I had a meeting with John Ziegler and the chairman of the board of Molson's, Morgan McCammon.
Yeah.
That hold them together. They were, particularly Molson's, was really nervous because they were ticked off in Canada.
There was a beer boycott, was there not?
More than that, in Winnipeg, they actually shot the office windows out at the Winnipeg Molson's office. And yeah, there was a boycott. And the idiot in Vancouver that voted no when the owner had told him to vote yet, I think was fired. And so it shifted around quickly. I knew right then and there, so interesting, the lowest moment became the highest. 3 days later, 4 days later. Honest to God. And it didn't take a lot of effort from me or the guys I was with. The league itself was so pissed off that they had, I forget the number. Well, what would it have been? 12? Yeah, 12 yeses and 2 votes flipped to no.
So you went into it with a bluff, in a way. Mm-hmm. And did you go out of it with a bluff?
Pretty much.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I'm not playing poker with you, man.
Well, here's the thing. They're a smart group over there. And they realized if we folded, okay, that there could have been huge antitrust legal ramifications. You see what I mean? And so they figured, all right. And that's why they should have done it at the end of the first year when there was a brief window. Imagine if you walk in, pray this never happens, but if you walk into your doctor and you know you've got bad cancer or a bad disease and the doctor says, well, I can get rid of it and I'll pay you $2 million. You don't take that deal? And that was the NHL thinking, because you had archaic thinking in there from a small group of owners. But who would listen to Harold Bauer? Somehow some people did. But common sense prevailed. Good guys like Ed Snyder, Billy Wirtz turned the corner and became a great advocate. Great advocate. You know, and most of them did, in fairness to them. But a few held out right until the end. And then, frankly, first few years in the NHL, I mean, Harold Ballard would always walk by me and grunt at me.
Really?
He would. I think we finally spoke when I went with my fiance Karen, who's we're married now. And he would always, I knew he didn't like me, but we got to the elevator at the Breakers. And, you know, we were trapped. So I said, I always called him Mr. Ballard. And I said, Mr. Ballard, how are you? And he said, I'd like you to meet my fiance, Karen Mulvihill. And he looks at her, he looks at me, and he grunts, oh, he says, well, honey, you're a lot better looking than the broad he had down here last year. That's God's honest truth. And I said, well, Mr. Ballard, thank you. And then we
what did Karen say?
She laughed. She said, well, I'll hold that over you for about 6 months. Then we actually got on the meanwhile, he's with his wife, who'd been to prison. I mean, I don't know. It was the craziest story I've ever known.
Wow. So were you ever cordial?
Yeah, I tell you, we were at the end. Because my buddy, Johnny Bassett, was a dear friend. He was dying. And Harold was damn good to him. And I told him that. And he grunted, you know, he said, okay, son, you know, I'm glad to do it. And we shook hands. That was it.
That's an amazing story. Was it cooler being an owner in the WHA or the NHL? Because you got to be both.
Oh, the WHA was fun because we had our meeting. And we would have meetings and we'd go through whatever we went through. But then that night, we all went out together to whatever city we were in. And we had a good time. We were all about the same age. And so we really had fun together. Now, I'm not saying I didn't have some fun in the NHL, but let's face it, playing croquet on the lawn of the Breakers. Bob, don't tell Gary I said this. I don't even know if you guys go to the Breakers anymore. Isn't as much fun as sneaking down to Tijuana after a WHA meeting.
Who's your best friend as a player that you got to know over the years in the WHA?
You know, I had a bunch. I mean, I loved Gordy. Mm-hmm. And Ronnie Francis in the later years, you know, and then in Pittsburgh, Mario. But certainly in the WHA, that first year team is still a very close-knit group. The Rick Lees, Larry Plows, Brad Sowards. We stay in touch 4 or 5 times a year with emails and updates. So I don't think I ever had a situation where I had a player that I didn't like. They were a good group of guys. And, you know, really through most of my career, I wasn't much older than them. So I always kept my distance, but I always liked
them. You did? I would have been partying up with them or hanging out with them.
No, you know, I learned, again, my experience in Philadelphia was great. They taught me a lot. And they realized you got to have a line there. And it doesn't mean you got to be stiff and boring, but you can realize that. I think only 2 times I took players out to lunch and said, you know, one was in the mid-80s and I had a lunch because he was unhappy about everything. And so I took him out to lunch and I said, look, I never do this, but I just want to give you advice. You have a God-given talent that enables you to earn about this was, you know, early in the 80s, that enables you to earn about 100, 125 grand a year. Take that talent and be blessed with it and then go get a regular job like the rest of the people instead of bitching about your dental plan. And it was kind of a nice lunch. We got along after that pretty well.
Who is that? Can you tell me?
Actually, I would tell you because I really like him. I'm not in touch with him. Chris Katsopoulos.
Okay.
He seemed to be an unhappy guy. We had a nice lunch at the Chucks right there in Hartford and chatted away. And I just told him that, and, you know, if he gets mad at me for telling the story, what am I going to do?
Chris, he'll call me anyway. Who's the other player you took out?
Early on, Wayne Carlton. and sort of had the same chat with him. You know, I never could understand how at such a young age when you're making, of course, now $100,000 a year is like meal money. But then it was a lot of money. And I never could understand how anybody could complain when you're in your early 20s earning that kind of money playing a game, how anybody could complain. But a lot of them did, you know, just like they do now, right?
I heard a story, I think it was John Garrett told me the story, in Minnesota, where they would get paid in paper bags getting on an airplane every now and then. Was everything good with you guys?
Well, we never had a problem like that, but that paper bag story was when the Minnesota Saints came to Hartford and they hadn't been paid and they weren't going to play. We had a sold out building. So I said to our CFO, go get the payroll and put it in paper bags, take it down and pay them, and I'll fight it out with the owner of the Saints. So we paid their players to play against us and they beat us 6-1. Payback is a bitch, right?
I didn't know it was you. I didn't know you lost the game as well. That's wild. I love the pod because it's such easy listening and you can do it while you're exercising or you can do it in a car ride. And like it's just so fluid with it. What do you want people who listen to this to come away from with what kind of message?
A great question. I hope they'll appreciate the players that jumped over and the courage it took. It didn't take a lot of courage for me to do whatever I did. When I was 28, 29, if I failed. But these players, you know, really took a chance. Jack Kelly took a chance. He had a great career going at BU hockey. And we should never forget, you know, the sport itself should never forget its roots and all the people that built the sport to what it is today. And that's players, executives, owners. But those players, like the guys we had in the Whalers, Darren, you know, you had Rick Lee, Bradshaw, those were all young Turks that had a bright future with Detroit or with Toronto, and they made that leap. Now, sure, they got more money, but if we failed, it would have been tough for them, you know? And so I hope people will forget that what you have today, I don't know what the average salary is, 3 million, 2 million, 8, whatever it is all because of what was done before. Not just the WHA, but others too. But the WHA had a huge impact on that.
Outstanding. I wish we could spend 2-3 hours doing this because I'd love to pick your brain. This is a big thrill and having been around the game as long as I have and followed you. So love it. I can't wait to listen to and follow along and the movie. I can't wait to see what happens with that.
Yep. We'll keep you posted. Thank you. See you later.
The podcast series is called Slim and None. We covered a lot there. But you really do have to go back and listen to it. And it's a really neat listen as far as how you go about doing it. If you want to long haul it across the country, put on the series and binge it, it's fine. Or pick off an episode once a week or during your workouts. It'll make it seamless. And you kind of get sucked into this world. There's some production value with it, some sound effects that go along with it. It's really well done. And I enjoyed it. And I knew a few of the stories going into it, and it was just a great refresher. Love it. You can get it anywhere you get your podcast, NHL.com or your favorite platform. And Harold Ballard stories. Like, can you imagine, Dick, you're in an elevator and somebody says that about your fiance? Oh my goodness. I can't stop laughing at it. I'm going to go right to the office right now and tell everybody about it. Thanks to Howard Baldwin. Awesome stuff. I hope you enjoyed it as well. We'll kind of dive into these different areas dealing with the history of the National Hockey League whenever we can. But Howard was a rival to the NHL and then he was part of the NHL. And in those days, it was really hard to make that transition and be part of both clubs. He does it. Good on you, Howard. Awesome stuff. Thanks to Bob Bender, who got a mention from Howard in the middle of that conversation, and you for listening to The Chirp with Darren Millard.